Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. How's everyone doing this evening?
Doing great.
Doing wonderful.
For our listeners, and we appreciate you tuning in, our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. If you'd like to join in on some of the conversation, please just press the button that you want to talk, and we'll bring you in on the conversation if you have a comment or a question. And let's start off with a disclaimer. We are not attorneys, and the Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. Please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, we want to say thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend a little bit of time this evening with us. Now, you know, we always talk about the IRP6. During the show, we're going to talk about that here in just a moment, but we also want to just give you a little bit of a heads up as to what our lineup is for the evening. We have a good lineup for you tonight. We're going to talk about prisoners' rights, and then we're also going to cover some current news and events, and, you know, we've got some interesting things there as well. As far as prisoners' rights are concerned, we have the director of the Incarcerated Nation campaign. He's going to be joining us in about half an hour or so. And then later in the program, we have Jeffrey Wansley. He's a gentleman who is incarcerated in the state of Mississippi, and he's been incarcerated now for 14 years for a crime that he says never happened. And when you read the story, it is just, you know, it's really crazy. Yeah. And this man, along with his supporters, have done a lot of homework, even down to the point of tracking serial numbers on dollars.
Yes.
That supposedly were used as part of a sting operation. So anyway, that should be an interesting conversation. Also, we have Maurice Muhammad, who is a grassroots organizer.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little tongue tied there. A grassroots organizer and supporter of Jeffrey Wansley. So he should be joining in on the show here a little bit later as well. Now, let's talk a little bit about the IRP6 and give a little bit of a update on that. If you've listened over the last couple of shows, we've focused in on an analysis related to the IRP6 case that was done by the Honorable Judge H. Lee Sterikin. Now, Judge Sterikin, he is a retired federal district judge as well as a retired appellate judge at the federal level. Now, we had Judge Sterikin on a few weeks ago, and talking about the appellate process and so forth. Since that time, the judge has taken a look at the IRP6 case. And as you know, Cliff and Ethel, one of the main points on appeal is the situation regarding over 200 pages mm-hmm. of a transcript that's missing, which would validate, substantiate, if you will, the fact that the guy's Fifth Amendment right was violated.
Yes.
Now, as we talk about the IRP6, we like to invite our listeners to go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. There's a lot of information out there, court documents and so forth. You will also see information about Judge Sterikin. You can go to ajcradio.com and click on Judge Sterikin's photo there, and it'll take you right to the archives of the show where we had him on. But what's interesting here is that Judge Sterikin did a three-part series on the case of the missing transcript. And we talked pretty extensively. In the previous shows, we talked a little bit about part one of his article, part two of his article. And so, Cliff, I know we want to spend just a little bit of time here talking about part three and the IRP6 being Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper, and talk about how these articles directly affect their case that is still currently under appeal. They have been incarcerated now for 2 years, waiting on the appellate courts in the 10th Circuit, in the Federal Circuit court system, to mm-hmm. you know, come back with a ruling on this.
Right.
So, Cliff, as you've talked to the judge personally, and then we also see his writings, you know, what do you think about part three here?
Well, part three, when you look at it, it's not just an article. I mean, this is Judge Sirikin is a, you know, like you said, he is formerly a federal judge, and he's an appellate judge. So this is written like from a judge's standpoint, from a judge's opinion on what the facts are. And, you know, he started off part three with saying that he had assumed that absent a transcript of precisely what was allegedly said by the judge to lead these defendants to believe that they were compelled to testify, that no resolution could be made of that issue. Then he goes on to say, however, after having read more of the record, the Court of Appeals has ample opportunity to accept the defendant's factual versions as true and be guided accordingly in its ruling. Here are the uncontested facts upon which the court could reach a determination that the right against self-incrimination was actually violated by the trial court, even without the critical transcript. And the ruling that came down by Judge Jackson, you know, it parlayed one way, parlayed another, all these things. But in the conclusion of it, he said it is undisputed. Mm-hmm. Undisputed by Judge Arguello, undisputed by the defendants, and undisputed by the prosecutor that something that was said, the judge's words, were not recorded, that they do not exist in the transcript. And, you know, you could use words like missing and try to say, well, they're not missing, they don't exist. Well, they don't exist, they're missing. If it wasn't recorded, it's missing. So Judge Sirikin laid out, 10 facts that says this is his opinion on the evidence of what went on here and why the Court of Appeals can accept the words of the IRP6 that this is what happened during that sidebar. And this is what this third part is about. It goes into detail, lays it out, and it's amazing the way that he did it. It really, really just says this is a decision they have the right to make.
And Cliff, before you jump into that list, let's kind of lay the foundation for our listeners. The IRP6, you know, developed software for federal, state, and local law enforcement, and they were accused of wrongdoing. The business got raided. IRP Solutions Corporation got raided in 2005. The guys went on trial, and you know, there was an indictment after two grand juries. I mean, that right there, we've talked about those kind of things in other shows. But anyway, there were two grand juries. They got indicted. Then they went on trial in 2011. They were convicted. During the trial, the prosecution rested their case a week and a half sooner than expected, therefore throwing the schedule totally out of whack. Judge Christine Arguello, she demands that the guys put somebody on the stand. They have a sidebar, and this is where a conversation transpired between Judge Arguello and the IRP6 where she forced them to get on the stand. That's where the argument comes from as far as the Fifth Amendment being violated. You are not to be compelled to testify against yourself, but that's what happened. And that incident is what is missing, and as we talked about before, if there are over 200 pages of a transcript missing, that's more than just that sidebar. There's a lot of stuff missing. But anyway, to just set the foundation for our listeners, that gives you a little framework to understand what we're talking about. When we're talking about the sidebar and the missing transcript, that's what we're talking about, is that the sidebar that occurred between Judge Christine Arguello, IRP6, she made them get on the stand, and then when they asked for the transcript so that they could contest that, that's missing. Okay, Cliff, if you want to go down on some of these items here.
Yeah, and the first one, I mean, Judge Sirikin starts to lay it out in the blog that he wrote. And he said, number one, the judge was frustrated at the slow pace of witnesses and said something to the defendants about the future of the trial. Then it says, you know, Ken Barnes, he takes the stand. No inquiry was made by the judge.
And let me jump in there. He says that something to the defendants about the future of the trial. That something was
right. Exactly. That something was if you don't have another witness or present your own on the stand, I will
rest your
case for you. And so it says that after Ken Barnes take the stand, the one of the key things that he points out is that no inquiry was made by the judge Arguello, regarding defendant's waiver of his right not to testify. And that is key because a judge is supposed to deal with the fact that she's supposed to give him instruction on what he is waiving, that, you know, if you testify, you know that you have the right to remain silent.
Exactly.
You have the right not to incriminate yourself.
Yes.
Your Fifth Amendment gives you the right that you do not have to testify.
Right.
And she's supposed to clarify that
exactly.
in front of the entire court when any time a defendant takes a stand, make sure, ask, were you coerced by anyone? Are you being forced to testify? Are you being threatened to testify? Those instructions are mandatory
right.
from a judge. And he lays out that this was not given. Inquiry was made by Judge Arguello.
Right.
It's like, and why wasn't any inquiry made? Because she said, you're going to get on the stand or I'll close your case.
That's right.
Then he says that shortly into the testimony, the U.S. attorney, and this is Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, not even the defendants, wanted to clarify that the defendants were going to testify despite the problem producing witnesses. So he's laying out that, hey, you see in the transcript where Kirsch is saying, okay, he's trying to give the judge out. And Judge Sarikin, he's trying to give Judge Arguello a way
out. Exactly.
And Judge Sarikin, in his opinion, he says clearly he, too, was concerned about the court's comments
exactly.
at the sidebar and that they might have been misinterpreted as being coerced. He goes down to say that after all this transpires and after, you know, they say that Ken invokes his Fifth Amendment right, like, you know, I don't want to be up here testifying. You're forcing me to do it. Then the judge comes back, Judge Arguello, she didn't recall her exact language, he says. And then he quotes her, I don't know what my exact phrasing was.
Right.
So I don't know exactly what I told you that caused you to feel like you had to get on the stand or I was going to close your case. I don't know what I said, but it wasn't that. Right.
Exactly.
His next point says, the failure to have a record of that conversation must be laid at the feet of the court or the government. The absence of this critical conversation, the transcript of which was called for and ordered that very day, certainly creates justifiable suspicion.
Yep.
So it's not like, you know, they waited until after the trial or anything like that. They're saying, we want to see if she didn't do it, why would we ask for the transcript immediately? Why would the defendant say, we want to have that in our hands so we have it as evidence that you forced one of us to testify? And then his next point says, Mr. Banks asked to see a copy of the transcript of the bench conference before proceeding further, and the court advised that the transcript would be provided at the end of the day. The court reporter has never, and you know, he puts in parentheses, to my knowledge,
exactly.
through affidavit or testimony, explained the absence of this entry. So court reporter Darlene Martinez has never come out and given a statement as to why is it that you didn't record that.
Exactly.
She's never said what happened in her view
that's right.
of why I didn't record that. Now, Judge Arguello says, well, maybe they were too far away from the microphone. Maybe her headphones fell off.
Right.
What does the court reporter say? What
that's
does
right.
she say? It's like, why didn't
she's not
you,
talking.
Yeah, why didn't you record the judge's conversation in that? And she never has come to the forefront to say, this is the reason I didn't. I mean, she would have been better off saying, you know, I was high, I was drunk, I blacked out, something. But just being quiet about it, it raises too many issues, too many flags. And then he says, when government cross-examination resumed, Mr. Barnes pled the Fifth in response to every remaining questions, all in the presence of the jury. And this is the key point. It is difficult to imagine anything
more
prejudicial. Now, this is a judge saying this. Judge Sarikin says it's difficult to imagine anything more prejudicial than that, than a defendant pleading for his Fifth Amendment right in front of a jury saying, please don't make me testify. I don't want to testify. It's doing this in front of a jury makes it look like something is wrong. But Judge Arguello says, oh, no. I didn't tell you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So why is he pleading for his Fifth Amendment
That's
right?
That's right.
Then it says his tenth
Number 10, yeah.
Number 10. Nor, to my knowledge again, has a court reporter or the U.S. attorney provided an affidavit or testimony of what they recall being said by the court, meaning Judge Arguello, nor denying what the defendant's claim was said by the court. This omission by the U.S. attorney speaks volumes.
That's strong.
Right.
That's
the fact that
they're saying nothing.
Right. The fact that Matthew Kirsch, who prosecuted the case, is silent on the matter. This is the Judge Sarakin is saying. This is not a just cause. This is not the defendant. This is a retired appellate judge saying that speaks volumes that the U.S. attorney is not saying anything about the situation. Then in closing, he says, with all this unconverted evidence, the Court of Appeals certainly has enough evidence to conclude that the right against self-incrimination indeed was violated by the trial court, Judge Arguello, that defendants reasonably believe that at least one of them was required to testify in order to have the defense remain open, and that they succumbed to that threat and immediately voiced their objections, lacking any competent evidence to rebut those claims of constitutional violations. The claim of the defendants must be recognized as valid, even without the missing entry in the transcript.
Absolutely.
And you know what, Cliff? 2 weeks ago, we had a volunteer from a Just Cause go to the courthouse, spent 5 hours in the courthouse combing through transcripts and records related to this case. And even on the civil side, Judge Jackson had put some exhibits in the order pertaining to this case, which represented what Darlene Martinez had said transpired during that sidebar. Well, our volunteer couldn't even find those exhibits.
Right, exactly.
Even with the assistance of the clerk in that courthouse.
And for the clerk to say, I don't see them. I don't see what you have in your hand here in the courthouse.
And I think one thing that I found interesting about Judge Jackson's motion is that he never put Darlene Martinez – he never directly asked her what happened, did he?
No.
Well, I mean, he did not talk to her at all, and you know.
Well, and the thing was, I mean, he's not at this point asking anybody what happened. He's just looking at, okay, what's going on here? So here in the transcript, the judge says, I said something. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Yep.
That's not in the transcript.
Exactly.
It's not missing. It wasn't recorded. Those are the same thing. It wasn't recorded, but it was said it's missing from the entire transcript.
That's it.
So he wasn't asking anybody. He
didn't
just,
ask her anything.
Just,
she didn't have to answer to anybody.
Well, if you'd like to read up on Judge Sarakin's articles, again, the Honorable Judge H. Lee Sarakin, retired federal district judge and retired federal appellate judge, wrote a 3-part series on the case of the missing transcript pertaining to the IRP 6 case. He wrote that on Huffington Post, and we would encourage you to go out there and read those articles. Very insightful, and like you said, Cliff, writing it from a judge's perspective, you know, it gives you a lot of insight as to the way people should be looking at this case, and it also gives you insight that, and Judge Sarakin even says, there is no reason for these men to be sitting in prison. Absolutely no reason at all. Okay, so if you'd like to join in on our conversation, our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We come back. We got a little story that we pulled offline. It's one of those stories, you know, as far as our things that make you go, So we're going to bring that when we come back. This is A Just Cause, Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman for Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
A registered nurse. I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was
arrested,
held in custody,
questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost.
Isolated.
Ostracized.
Misjudged.
Terrified.
And in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life.
And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice.
They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
There are approximately 2 million children in the juvenile and criminal justice system in this country. These are the faces of those families. If you are the family member of a child who has been in the justice system, or if you are someone who supports this movement and is ready to make a difference, visit the Campaign for Youth Justice at www.campaignforyouthjustice.org.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
Black and wrongly convicted,
yeah.
serving time somewhere in prison. You are left all by yourself.
And all you want
is some help.
Come on,
tell me who you gonna call. I just wanna know. Is it Obama?
No.
The Black Caucus?
No.
Al Sharpton?
No.
Jesse Jackson?
No.
What's a few beers?
If you don't stop your friend from drinking and driving, you're as good as dead. Drinking and driving can kill a friendship.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We were just talking about the articles out on Huffington Post that were published by Judge H. Lee Sarakin. We want to encourage you to go out there and look at it. We also have a petition pertaining to the over 200 pages of transcript that is found on change.org. Again, change.org, do a search on the IRP6. And Ethel, what else can folks do as far as helping out with that?
Absolutely. We're also asking people to get your family and your friends and ask them to, you know, pick up the phone and call Attorney General Eric Holder's office. His number is 202-514-2003 and 205. And ask him to investigate this over 200 pages of missing trial transcript in the case of the IRP6. These men have been wrongly convicted. They've been in prison now for over 2 years, and they need to be home. So if you guys would do that, just pick up the phone and call his office, make that inquiry. Again, the number is 202-514-2003 and 2005. We would appreciate it.
And to the jurors of the IRP 6 case, we want to reach out to you and let you know that if you have questions about things that happened during this case, you have questions about, you know, this 200 pages of missing transcript, evidence that you weren't allowed to see. Some of the jurors said, you know, that they were waiting for the IRP 6 to bring up their evidence. Well, it was evidence that the judge would not allow to be seen. So if you have questions about any of that, you know, we don't blame you as the jurors for coming to the conclusion that you did, for the verdict that you brought back. We blame Judge Arguello for the way that she forced the trial to go to ensure that a conviction was brought down against these men. So if you want to reach us, you have questions, anything that we can answer, we will answer for you. Call us at 855-529-4252. Again, that's 855-529-4252. Or send us an email at contact@a-justcause.com. And also, we have, you know, with the fact that, you know, we were talking about Judge Sarakin looking into this and how many people have come back and say, you know, what are these men doing in prison? How could this case have gone this way? We also have, you know, international support. We have a reporter that's in the United Kingdom. And her name is Tracy Collins, and she is doing investigation on the IRP 6 case.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And she's coming up basically with the same questions. First off, what are these men doing in prison? How did things happen during this case the way that they did? You know, like, why were there two grand juries, a panel, when the first grand jury came back with no indictment? You know, Matthew Kirsch, the prosecutor, went to a second grand jury and only called one FBI agent to testify so that he could get his indictment. And she's been talking to the, you know, the spokesman up in Denver, Jeff Dorshner, who is the spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and really has been digging for information and just grilling him and pulling answers out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've gotten is that Dorshner has told her that, you know, he admitted that the IRP 6 appeals case is the oldest case in the Denver Court of Appeals office. Now, that right there is like, come on. This case, 200 pages of missing transcript.
Absolutely.
That is not a difficult decision to make.
Sound like to me it should have been the first one out.
That exactly.
Absolutely.
You got missing court records. Throw this back to the district.
That's
court
right.
And say either retry them or put the case out and get these men out of prison. So everywhere you look, you know, from here to the UK to everywhere, people are realizing that this case is just really, really bogus. The government went on a witch hunt.
And, you know, the Tracy is very good. She's pressing them. I mean, she's not letting up one bit, and I like that.
And she is spending hours.
Hours, yes.
And so she's just not, you know, scratching the surface.
That's
And doing this cursory look at it. I mean, she is digging deep.
Investigative reporting.
Absolutely. And even if a question comes up pertaining to the IRP 6, you know, if she gets some information from someone else that she's interviewing,
mm-hmm.
And if it uncovers some question that she needs clarification on, she's asking all the right questions.
That's
and
right.
The hard questions.
That's it.
So it's not that she's just she's almost taking the same approach as Judge Sarakin.
Yes.
From the standpoint of, you know, she is doing an investigation. Now,
girl,
what she's finding
mm-hmm.
out mm-hmm. is that, like everyone else has found out who's really took the time to look deep.
Yes.
Is that this whole thing, it stinks.
That's right.
And the IRP 6 should not be incarcerated.
That's right.
So, you know, we need to, you know, shout out to Tracy on that.
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to her, you know, her final mark. Well, if you follow Just Cause Coast to Coast, you know what that music means. That is our segment on things that make you go, You know, NPR Radio did a segment on, you know, the craziness that goes on with fines and fees and courts and so forth. And so there's even an article that talks about it out online. It says, as court fees rise, the poor are paying the price. Now, here's the first thing on, you know, and NPR has done an extensive study on this, and they've gone state to state and looked at all kinds of things. Now, to set the stage, back in 1983, I believe it was, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case, Bearden versus Georgia, that people cannot be sent to jail simply for being too poor to pay fines and fees.
Mm-hmm.
The court said someone could be sentenced only if he or she had the money to do so, but willingly refused to pay. Now, but the justices did not define what that meant. So the result is that all too often judges are left to make the difficult calculation who's too poor to pay and who can but didn't. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of situations that they pointed out here. Here's one where there's a gentleman, Tom Barrett,
mm-hmm.
in Augusta, Georgia. A judge sentenced Mr. Barrett to 12 months after he stole a can of beer worth less than
$2.
Now, you know, we're not advocating theft or anything like that, but a $2 can of beer. Now, here's what happened. NPR found out that Tom Barrett was offered a court-appointed attorney, but he turned down the court-appointed attorney because he had to pay a $50 administration fee that he could not he couldn't afford. So after he looked at it, he thought, you know, later he said he probably made a mistake, but at the same time, the way this whole thing adds up, it makes no sense. It's definitely one of those things that make you go, You know, his costs added up to, because he the deal that he got, he ended up having an ankle monitor.
Mm-hmm.
The ankle monitor cost him $400 a month. $400 a month. That's and so that includes the daily monitoring of this electronic service. Now, Barrett was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
His only income, other than food stamps,
right.
came from the $35 that he got selling his plasma to the blood bank.
Mm-hmm.
So he quickly fell behind in his payments and ended up in jail. Is that not a thing that make you go,
I mean,
$2 can of beer.
A $2 can of beer lands you in jail. And like Sam said, you know, we're not advocating go out, steal beer, or anything like that. But come on, this the system is, what this article is laying out is that the system is geared against the poor. And you they get these fines, and it says the common thread in these cases, because there's many cases in this article.
Yeah, several.
The common thread is that the jail time wasn't punishment for the crime, but for failure to pay the increasing fines and fees associated with the criminal justice system. So we're not putting you in jail because you stole the $2 of beer. It's because you didn't pay the fine we charged you for court calls.
You know, that sucks.
These are indigent people. These are people without jobs. A homeless man, and you're giving him fines. Like, well, I don't have a job. I don't have a place to stay.
Yeah.
I have no collateral. You're going to fine me and then put me in jail when I don't pay. And when NPR did a state-by-state survey of they found that defendants are charged for many government services that were once free, including those that are constitutionally required. Now, this is just sickening here. In at least 43 states and the District of Columbia, defendants can be billed for a public defender.
Yeah.
The public defender is already being paid,
by
the public. That's why it's called a public defender, and then you pay the defendant. In at least 41 states, inmates can be charged room and board for jail and prison stay. You put me in here. I didn't ask to be locked up.
Now, check out this one. There was one in the state of Colorado. The ACLU fought this. They challenged the practice in courts in three Colorado cities.
Mm.
Now, one example happened in Westminster, Colorado. A gentleman by Mr. Thornburg, he was ticketed for making an illegal left turn. He went to court, and it was dropped to a defective vehicle. The ticket was $165 in fines and fees. He, too, was homeless and unemployed. He had recently lost his job. And he was in the oil field, and then he got a workplace. So he had lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
The day before he was to start a new job at Taco Bell, he was arrested for not paying the fines. Again, $165. He was arrested for not paying the fines, which had increased to $306. He was sentenced to 10 days in jail. It says that the city of Westminster, Colorado, they spend about $70 a day to keep somebody in jail. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, 10 days in jail, $70 a day, $700 to the city of Westminster, Colorado, mm-hmm. for something that started off as a $165 fine.
And how do you get a defective vehicle for $165? And what was the fine for making the illegal left turn?
Yeah.
If they dropped it down to defective vehicle, yeah. And $165.
And the ACLU is saying, you know, how is this humanely right?
Exactly.
You know, it cost the taxpayers more than what the fine was for, and it wasted 10 days of this man's life.
Yeah, and it says, gratefully, the governor of Colorado signed a law that mm-hmm. tells judges they can't send people to jail simply because they're too poor to pay fines and fees. And one of the things that I thought was really, you know, sickening with what one of the judges said in mm-hmm. here is that, you know, we have to send them to jail because we have to make it so that they understand that if they don't pay their fine, then they have to go to jail for the crime they paid.
Yeah, hold them accountable for breaking the law.
That's being held accountable for breaking the law. That's sending people to jail because
exactly.
they're poor.
And it goes back to debtor's prison.
Yeah, and you know what? And then I was looking at this here. Benson County collects just a fraction of all fines and fees it owes, but the county still collected $13 million in 2012. Make it one of the state's top revenue producers by making people pay these fines.
Even that's sick, the way that even sounds.
I know.
It's looked at as a revenue stream.
That's
oh, my goodness.
It's like we're going to let everybody know that if we don't put you in prison, then, if you don't pay your fine, you're going to prison because we have to get that revenue. And it says NPR found sweeping discrepancies across the country over how courts make those decisions. Some judges will tell an offender to give up their phone service or quit smoking cigarettes and use the money instead to pay court debt. Next, they're going to tell you, don't eat, don't pay your utilities, don't buy your kid any food.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
Don't pay your rent, but pay those court fees.
Well, it's almost like this man already got $35 to sell his blood. I mean, my God, how much further are they going to go?
There you go. Well, we're going to be doing a segment on debtor's prison toward the middle of June. And so, you know, we're going to talk about this type of stuff along with all kinds of other things that, you know, talk about the craziness of debtor's prison and how, you know, debtor's prison was done away with. But, you know, people are using...
Or so we thought. Man.
Yeah, they're using a little wiggle room there in the law to bring it back. So, at any rate, Ethel, I know you had another story here. I think we can touch on it pretty quickly here before our next break.
Okay.
The mentally ill prisoner in Rikers Island found dead and covered in feces.
Oh, my God. And that's really short, but it was sick. You know, I thought this is ridiculous. The Associated Press says that the man, Bradley Ballard, was sentenced to Rikers Island for a parole violation and was confined to his cell for 7 days after he made lewd gestures at a female guard. And now they know he had a history of mental illness, and he was taking daily medication for schizophrenia and diabetes. The prison guards denied him his medication for a week, something that he's supposed to have been taking daily. When they finally checked in his cell, they realized that his toilet was clogged, and he was covered in feces, and his privates were swollen and infected, and he could barely move, and they rushed him to the hospital, and he died hours later. They were talking about, under the New York State law, mental health staffers must check on mentally ill prisoners twice per day, but the staff at Rikers Island checked on this man one time in 7 days.
What?
One time.
One time in
one
7 days.
One time in 7 days. This is just ridiculous.
And, you know, again, I think this is one of those situations where this kind of thing happens, and you never, ever hear about what happened to the corrections officer or the law enforcement person or what have you.
Oh, they're currently investigating. That's what they always say. That's usually the way it is.
Yeah.
And
using our phrase that we use quite often here on the program, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, there are people who take their jobs seriously. But when you have this type of negligence and this type of thing that results in a person's death, That's uncalled for.
Sam, that baby is holding on by his toenails. Do you understand?
Oh, wow. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We'll be right back after these messages. Don't go anywhere.
Congress
shall make no law
respecting an establishment
of religion
or prohibiting the free exercise
thereof
or abridging the freedom of speech
or of the press
or the right
of the people peaceably
to assemble
and to petition
the government
for a redress of grievances.
Americans are standing trial for crimes they didn't commit. Today, innocent Americans are writing for help from a prison cell. Today, hundreds of Americans have been exonerated of crimes they didn't commit. Researchers believe that at least 40,000 innocent Americans still sit behind bars. For them, the answers do not come easy. A Just Cause seeks true balance and accountability in the judicial process, ensuring that innocent men and women are not convicted and sentenced to prison for trivial, obscure acts that are otherwise not seen as crimes. For more information on how A Just Cause may help you or how you can get involved to stop over-criminalization of innocent Americans, visit www.a-justcause.com or call 855-529-4252. That's 855-529-4252.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. I'd like for you to encourage you to go out and find out a little bit more about A Just Cause. Go to www.a-justcause.com. www.a-justcause.com. A lot of helpful resources and information about our organization is out there. And you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. So let's talk a little bit about prisoners' rights. And I know, Ethel, you got something there that you were going to touch on here for a moment.
Yes, this is about prisoners' rights, and talking about the federal and the state laws govern how they govern the establishment and administration of prisons, as well as the rights of the inmates. And I was looking at this part that talks about that the inmates are protected by the Constitution's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment under Amendment 8. And the protection requires prisoners to be afforded a minimum standard of living. And, you know, I looked at that and I thought about some of the things that when we visited with the IRP 6 and they talked to us about the different things that they go through there, you know, since they've been there and the things that they've seen and even down to the food that they eat.
Yep.
You know, and some of the stuff is marked not for human consumption and the stuff is expired and it's molded and all of this different all of this stuff. You know, I mean, what constitutes the minimum standard of living? What is that?
And when you look at this article, and the thing that I thought was, you know, I guess it's not really obvious, but it says Congress has given federal prison officials full discretion to control prisoner classification as affecting conditions of confinement.
Uh-huh.
And generally such matters are left to the control of the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Mm-hmm.
But when they define this this term, you know, this classification of confinement, this is used here is meant to describe the custodial classification of a prisoner once he or she is convicted, mm-hmm. meaning maximum versus minimum security, mm-hmm. solitary confinement, etc. So you can have and when they say prison officials, you're talking about the guard.
Right.
You're talking about the warden.
Yep.
You're talking about any rookie guard who doesn't understand what's going on there. Just any person that's an official, they can take their personal belief. They can take their personal fears.
Yes.
They can take any type of preconceived notion they have about prisoners and use that to say this person should go to solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? Because
yeah.
you're too big and you stumbled and almost fell into me and now I'm scared of my life because you almost crushed me in a wall. When you look at this, it's like there needs to be oversight. You can't just have – these people are not trained
mm-hmm.
in the psychology of, like, solitary confinement,
what
it does to a person. There is like, okay, I'm a prison guard. I'm here to make sure people don't get in fights or things of that nature. How is it left to them to say – this is how a person should spend their time confined, and not only the prisoners who are guilty of the crime,
mm-hmm.
and should be there for their crime, but mm-hmm. still treated humanely. But then for the person who has never committed a crime in their life, is unjustly incarcerated, mm-hmm. wrongfully convicted, mm-hmm. is fighting to try to give out, has all of this pressure on them, and they leave it to any prison official to make the determination of where you spend your time while you're already locked up.
Totally ridiculous. Totally.
And, you know, talking about prison rights, one of the things that Gary Walker, one of the IRP 6, experienced when they first got to the federal prison camp there in Florence was his glasses.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the being denied his glasses and Gary, I guess, without his glasses, qualified as legally blind.
Exactly.
I mean, he could not look across the field and be able to make out anything.
Exactly.
And the camp administrator at that time,
mm-hmm.
Griggs, he basically went to, you know, when Gary went to him and kept asking, you know, what can we do to get my glasses? And Griggs, you know, went off on him. He's like, why do you keep coming to me about your glasses?
And that big gorilla sitting there wearing his glasses.
And you know, it's that kind of thing where you know, that's cruelty.
Yes, that is cruel and unusual punishment.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. These are the definitions of torture. And when you look at the ACLU's creed on prisoner rights and the things that they want reform on, and when you look at what they're asking for reform, these are the basics of life. This is the basic, okay, this should be how any human is
mm-hmm.
treated
mm-hmm.
just in a humane fashion. This is medical care in prison. Why do you have to campaign for medical care in prison.
Exactly.
These are real humans.
Exactly.
They say mental health care in prison.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying prison is becoming just a place where they, instead of putting, people with patients that have mental health issues,
right,
instead of putting them in some type of asylum where they can be given proper care, they're just shipping them off to prison and
exactly,
locking them in a cell and hiding them from society. Then you have the prison conditions, like you said, Ethel, the food saying it's been expired for 10 years.
Yes.
The different type of hygiene, being able to say, okay, I have a clean toilet, I have a clean shower, I have just the basic things that I need for daily living. Private prison, they said these prisons run by for-profit corporations drive the demand for more people to be locked up while at the same time ducking public scrutiny and accountability.
That's
so
ridiculous.
They can just say, just like we did a few segments back where these private prisons are saying they're guaranteed by the state to basically push in this many prisoners.
That's
how do you
right.
guarantee we're going to have this many criminals that will lock up in your facility?
Yeah,
that
becomes kidnapping and slavery.
That's
when
what they're doing.
You're guaranteed, like, we will sell you this person.
Yeah,
we guarantee.
Yeah.
If you bring the money, we'll sell you this person
exactly.
to work for you.
Exactly.
And, you know, one of the other things, even with where the IRP 6 are right now, and Cliff, as you were talking about, you know, any prison official and how guards respond to different inmates and so forth. But even in Florence,
mm-hmm.
okay, that is a facility mm-hmm. that has supermax,
mm-hmm.
it has maximum security,
right.
has medium security,
mm-hmm.
and then it has what they call a prison camp.
Right. Yeah.
But therein lies the problem.
Yes.
It's because they rotate all of the corrections officers between all of these facilities.
Yes, right.
So you have a corrections officer that's one day, he is sitting in the maximum security
yeah, right.
facility, and then the next day, he's at the camp.
Absolutely.
And he's
Absolutely.
Treating the people at the camp the same way he's treating the people at the maximum security facility.
But, you know, when you guys were going down there, years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so, and volunteering,
yep.
and one of the guards was telling Pastor Banks about these are not men, these are animals, and you
yep.
have to treat them as such.
Yep.
Well, that's the mentality. You
that
know, if you have that mentality, that's how you're going to treat them.
And imagine taking that mentality from the maximum security, because that's what we used to volunteer, was at the maximum
that's
security.
That's right.
So you take that maximum security mentality
exactly.
and take it to the camp.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they bring it from the ADX, where, I mean, you go from saying, okay, today I'm dealing with somebody like Gotti,
mm-hmm.
the Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with the Unabomber.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with, you know, a Jeffrey Dahmer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day you're at the camp.
That's it.
Saying, okay, now you're dealing with people who are in minimum security.
Yeah.
That if they chose to, they could walk off when they felt like it.
Yeah.
But you take that same mentality. It's like the prison officials are in the zone to deal with maximum, supermax inmates. And then they take that same mindset. That's why that idiot Griggs came over there to the visitor center at the camp and tell people this is not a social hour.
Exactly.
It's like, how do you even have that mindset? Because he's like, I came from ADS where there is no social.
Okay.
I come from maximum security where everybody's locked up in a cell.
Mm-hmm.
Then he comes over to the camp with the same mindset, like, hey, everybody shut up, sit down. I have to be I'm basically
in charge.
Yeah.
Right. I'm in charge and I have to force my authority on everybody.
And you've got
to try
kids.
To get them
kids and everything running around playing.
But
he's
shouting this out to family members and children.
Yes.
It's like, well, if it's not a social hour, what are we doing here?
Absolutely. Oh my goodness.
So, you know, those are the kind of things that from a prison rights perspective, that, you know, we observe. There are a lot of people that are doing studies on that kind of thing, but is anyone doing anything to fix it?
Right.
You know?
That is the question.
And so, you know, and number one, when you take, like, the IRP-6, and we know that they didn't do anything.
Exactly.
Yet they've been incarcerated now for over 2 years.
That's right.
and having to be subjected to this type of stuff.
Absolutely.
And then when you talk about their living conditions, I mean, Congress has even done studies on this and had hearings on the fact that you take a 2-inch foam, what they call a mattress, and guys are getting out of there with back problems, neck problems. We had one of the exonerees here from the state of Colorado, Ryder. And you know, and he's had how many surgeries?
He's on his back. He's having another one done on his neck. And you look at it, you look at that part of it, and you see, like, okay, here's people who spent time in prison. But even when you go to, who was it, the one of the directors or one of the wardens or somebody that spent the night in solitary confinement and said he felt like he was going to lose his mind. Now, you're talking about he spent one day in there.
That's it.
And almost lost his mind.
And he came out and spoke and was like, this is humane. We shouldn't treat anybody like this.
Exactly.
But what is the BOP doing about the prisoners' rights that are basically laying on this 2-inch foam, supposed to be a pad, is just like it's a rollout.
Yeah,
you lay that on a metal slab that they're calling a bunk bed. I mean, it has no give. You're on
metal or concrete.
That's right.
You're
metal,
playing
that's
on a piece
it.
Of metal or a piece of concrete. Mm-hmm. It's not flexing with your body, and you lay on that night after night. And then they're only 6 feet long. You have people like my brother Clint. He's 6'3". Ken Barnes. He's 6'3".
Mm-hmm.
How do you even lay out on this spot? Because if you lay your feet over it, then your feet are on this thin piece of metal that you're cutting your ankles on. And it's how do they call that a humane environment and that basically satisfy your constitutional rights?
Absolutely. And then you have people, and you were talking about Dewey, but you know, as far as the surgeries and stuff, but you also have people with the food that are coming out sick. I mean, look at Lamont Banks. Diabetes.
Yes.
Diabetes. I mean, my God, you know, from the food and stuff that he was eating while in this prison. This is ridiculous.
Well, and they all talk about the diet is just horrendous.
Horrendous.
And like you were saying, as far as outdated food, food that has packaging that says not fit for human consumption. And how can people get away with that kind
Absolutely.
Of thing? It makes no sense.
Yeah, and then just the little amount of protein and vegetable matter that they get. Mostly everything is some carbohydrate that they just – it's like, okay, well, we throw these carbs at you. I need protein to live. I need a vegetable to stay healthy. I mean, to
– Assalamu alaikum. You reach Maurice Muhammad.
All right. Yeah, we had a little bit of a technical issue there.
Oh, gosh.
Go ahead, Cliff. What's your point?
Yeah, I was saying, you know, we as a Just Cause had to petition the vendor down at Florence in the visiting center to say, okay, can you guys put something in here that's more nutrition? And they were gracious enough. They start putting salads in there. They start putting, you know, things that actually had a real piece of meat.
Absolutely.
And, you know, just to have those things where it's like, okay, one of the highlights of the inmates' visit is I can get a handful of fresh vegetables. I can get a piece of tomato. I can get a piece of carrot. This is not, I mean, the FDA says we need 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Well, how many are they getting in there? And we're talking about fresh fruits and vegetables. Guaranteed that's not happening.
That's
It's not going to happen.
Oh.
Not at all. Hey, got a quick programming note here. One of the guests that we were expecting to be on the program this evening, Fahd Malikum, he is the program director of the Incarcerated Nation campaign, will not be joining us tonight, so our producers are working on getting him rescheduled. But at least we wanted to give our listening audience an update on that one since we talked about it at the top of the program. Again, the program director for the Incarcerated Nation campaign is not going to be joining us this evening. We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
These are the voices that prisoners in solitary confinement hear every day. Out of Arizona's total of 2,076 prisoners held in solitary, 30% are taking prescription medication to deal with mental illnesses, and 11% have diagnosed schizophrenia. Experts report that the extreme and prolonged isolation exacerbates pre-existing conditions and appears to even cause mental illness in prisoners who were not previously ill. While prisoners deserve punishment, Arizona can do better. We need to change the solitary confinement rules. Unlike any other states, Arizona prisoners are held in 8x10 cells for at least 23 hours a day, with no windows and virtually no human interaction. Perhaps the best way to fix solitary confinement so it strikes a balance between punishment and humanity is to decrease the size of solitary units. Colorado, Texas, Mississippi, and Illinois have decreased the size of their units, only admitting prisoners who need the rehabilitating experience, and have saved over $6 million without compromising prison safety. A study produced in Colorado reported that after decreasing the number of solitary units, prisoners experienced an improvement in overall mental health to the confined inmate population. How can we do this? We need to reach out to Director of Corrections Charles L. Ryan, asking him to decrease the number of solitary units. Solitary confinement needs to remain a place for punishment and behavior change, but it can also be a place of innovation and rebuilding.
You are listening to AJ Radio. When you call, the phone, all they have is an excuse. Now, one more thing. When the fire's burning, yeah. And your life comes crumbling down, all of these so-called activists, but not a one to be found. Come on. You all know Oprah. Over Africa, black man here, she won't help. So tell me who you gonna call. I just wanna know, is it Obama, the black caucus, Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, or what about Oprah?
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Welcome to the program. Thanks for taking a little bit of time out of your evening to sit in and listen with us. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, if you have a comment or a question, our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And also you can go to AJCRadio.com, again, AJCRadio.com, and take a look at some of the other folks that we've had on the program. We had a lot of very interesting people. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to be talking to Jeffrey Wansley. And Mr. Wansley has been incarcerated now for over 14 years for a crime that he did not commit, and that story is just crazy. We do have one of his supporters that's joining in right now, and this is Maurice Muhammad. And Mr. Muhammad is a grassroots organizer, and he is a supporter of Mr. Wansley's efforts to right the wrong in this wrongful conviction. Maurice, are you there, sir?
Well, peace and blessings. Thank you, Brother Thurman and Brother Stewart, for having me on. It's definitely a pleasure to be able to come on the airwaves and talk about the injustice that is happening to Brother Jeff.
So how did you get involved with Jeffrey's case?
Well, I came across Twitter. His daughter, Sister Amy Hunter, she was tweeting one day about her father, and a sister by the name of Shawnez, I told her to get in touch with me, and she tweeted me, and we started having that conversation on Twitter about what it was and what's going on, and I gave them my number, and they called me up and sat me down and explained to me everything that has been going on, and myself being a person that helps those that been wrongfully convicted. This was a new case that I've never seen one like it because the actual crime that supposedly happened never even took place. So it was a very interesting conversation, to say the least.
So just to give our listeners a little bit of background on the Jeffrey Wansley case, this is a case that supposedly a drug sting went down. But after, I mean, even after after the trial, after conviction, everything was fabricated. It's like there was no evidence. They say that they had some marked bills. There was no marked money, no drugs, no weapons, no audio tape, no videotape, no photos of any drugs, large sums of money, and there was nothing, no documentation from the Mississippi Crime Lab proving that any of the alleged evidence even existed. So, you know, how can you end up in prison and have no evidence?
And, you know, the only thing that I can say is only in America. Down there in Mississippi, it's like a different world where this crime took place down in Union, Mississippi. It's like a totally different world. And so you would not think that level of injustice actually happens here in America, but it does. We even took this complaint to the Justice Department. I had to sit out in Eric Holder's office to wait for him to walk by so I could finally get in contact with him and talk to him about this case. And even him hearing it and showing him, I'm showing him documentations, and he's like, no, 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 something else is missed, something is not, that can't be like that. We even went and sat with Congressman John Lewis, and he made a call down there to the judge in that case to find out, you know, what's really going on. He called the prosecutor. But at the end of the day, his stand was, Mississippi is a different beast than a lot of these other ones. It is as corrupt as it has ever been. And just like we had to fight during our time, it's your time now that y'all got to fight. So if y'all want Jeff to be free like we all do, it's going to take some fighting. And you have to go down there and you're going to have to get dirty in order to bring the right public attention to it to help Brother Jeff get free. So this is a beast.
And you know what, Maurice, this is Cliff. Talking about Congressman Lewis and all these so-called civil rights activists, and that statement right there just really you know, that's disgusting. To, for him to say, well, we fought our fight, now you're going to have to go fight. No, you were put in office, Congressman, so that you could fight with us. That when we come to you, that you are, you're there in the Civil Rights Division, you're there as a congressman, you have the means to lead us in. That's what you're in place for, not to tell us, well, y'all going to have to go fight on your own. That's not what he's there for. And we have gotten the same type of feedback from Lewis, Conyers, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton,
Vernon Jordan,
all of them who have been put in these positions by the people. I mean, they didn't get there on their own. They were put in positions. They have the platform to raise enough awareness, to make a big enough noise, to scream loud enough that everyone in America would hear them. And so how does he tell you, now it's your time to go down there and fight?
Exactly.
No, you get on. He should have carried you there and said, let's go wage war, and he started up and show you how to do the fight. That's what he's there for.
That's right.
And that, they get to me so bad, so bad.
And you know what, Maurice, and on that point, you know, commend you for your efforts and staying in the fight,
yeah,
and not being discouraged. But like Chris said, you know, we have folks who came through the civil rights struggles and people who lost their lives to ensure that people like Congressman Conyers, mm-hmm, and Lewis are able to sit in those offices in,
yeah,
Washington, D.C., and then for them to tell you, you know, no, I got mine, now you go get yours. I mean, that's almost like a reflection of slavery in the plantation.
Absolutely.
It's like, hey, I managed to come through the front,
yeah,
door.
Exactly.
Now, you know, you go back through the back door until you figure out how to get through the front door.
That's,
I mean,
it.
That's basically
that's
what he's
it.
Saying.
Yeah.
It's like I'm in the big house.
Yeah, yeah.
So you field folks, quote, unquote. Y'all do what you got to do, but,
mm-hmm,
don't come mess with my position.
That's
in
it.
The big house. I'm a house folk now.
And you know
all
what,
right,
Maurice? And we had a situation with Congressman Lewis at one time as well, where we were right there in his office. And rather than hearing about the story of the injustice related to the IRP 6, he wanted to show us his view. He had the view over the plaza, overlooking where Martin Luther King spoke his I Have a Dream speech. That's all fine and good, you know, and we are not slamming or bashing any of our history.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a saying that if you forget your history, you're bound to repeat it.
That's
well,
right.
That's exactly what that's they're
right.
setting us up for. I mean, when they tell you we fought,
mm-hmm,
ours, that you go get yours, it's like, have you forgotten your history?
That's right.
I mean, if you're going to take that attitude, then you are going to make us repeat it.
That's
exactly.
it.
Exactly. You're going to make us
exactly.
refight the fight that got you in position.
Hey, Maurice, hang tight. We got, you know, the gentleman that you are fighting so hard for, Jeffrey Wansley. He is
okay.
joining us on the phones now, and I think Jeffrey has a limited time because he's actually calling from the facility where he is incarcerated. And so we want to bring him in on this conversation. And, Maurice, and you are going to – your mic is going to be live. So we're going to allow you to jump in there as well. Welcome to the program, Mr. Wansley. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
We are doing well, doing well. On the phone, we also have Maurice Muhammad, who is a supporter, helping to fight for your cause. And so we wanted to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about your story and what you want people to do as far as so give us a little bit of background, you know, that firsthand account as to what went wrong in this case.
Well, the first thing I had only been in Mississippi about 5 months, so I was new to the situation, and I guess they figured that if they got me, they could intimidate me. So a police officer came up to me, and he told me that the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics wanted to ask me some questions. I asked him, was I under arrest for anything? And he said, no, they just wanted to ask you some questions. So he took me over to Travis Windham's house. He's an ex-police officer. And they were searching his house. And they didn't find anything. And after I had sat in a hot police car for about 2 hours, they came to me and asked me would I sign a consent to search my house. So I did, not having anything to hide. And after they searched my house, nothing was found. So I asked the chief of police, was I under arrest for anything? And he said, no, they just wanted to ask you some questions. So he took me back uptown to jail in a holding tank, and I was waiting these questions. Little to my knowledge that while I was sitting in jail, Narcotta agent Stanley Washhead went to Municipal Court Judge Rex Gordon and got an affidavit for my arrest signed. Now, I know that they didn't find any evidence in my house, and I know that they didn't have me under surveillance or anything. So the chief of police came back there and got me, and I assumed that he was releasing me because he released me onto the street. But when I walked out the door, Narcotta agent Brian Patterson ran up to me, and he fired me, really, and he said, you're under arrest. And I said, for what? And he said, the sale of cocaine, 5 counts. One count of possession, 1 count of conspiracy. So I asked him, how did I get all these charges? He didn't respond. So they took me down to Newton County Jail and booked me in. That's where I met Narcotta agent Stanley Watson. And the whole thing about it, he wanted me to testify on Trellis. And I told him that I didn't know anything about Trellis's personal business. But he insisted that I did. And I told him that whatever I testified to, you would have to put those words in my mouth. And due to my religious belief, I'm not willing to get up on a witness stand and promise to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, so help my God, and then lie on a man. And not only lie on him, they wanted me to lie on myself. So I refused. And immediately he took me in front of our municipal court judge, Rex Gordon, who quoted to me that I had 7 charges at $25,000 each, giving me a bond of $175,000. Now, I assumed all this was to intimidate me into testifying on trial. After 2 months, I still refused to testify, so they immediately rushed me in front of a court. Now, before all this happened, I asked the judge to give me a preliminary hearing. I asked him to give me the discovery so I can just see the evidence they had against me. And I asked to be represented by my own attorney. They denied all of that. So before these 2 months was up, they rushed me in front of Judge, Circuit Court Judge Brandon Cotton. And he asked me, how did I plead? I pleaded not guilty. And that Monday, he asked me, how did I plead again? I pleaded not guilty. I advised him that I wanted my own attorney at that particular point in time. And he had a 5-minute recess and conferred with Circuit Court Judge Marcus Gordon. And when they returned, Marcus Gordon came back with him, and he was looking at me with anger in his face. And I'm like, you know, that's a right that I have to have my own attorney. So Brandon Cotton said that when you were first arrested, you requested a court-appointed attorney. And your court-appointed attorney is still your attorney. Your trial is set for tomorrow. Now, wow. That only gave me 1 day. That only gave me 1 day to try to prepare for a trial.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
And the next day, I was rushed into trial. I was rightfully threatened. Marcus Gordon told the deputies that if I didn't come to trial, they had orders to drag me into trial. Now, I still haven't met my court-appointed attorney at that time. So when I got in front of Mr. Gordon, I let him know that he was violating my constitutional rights, and we had a little conversation, which is all part of the transcript, and he just told me he didn't want to hear anything else I had to say, that he was going on with the trial, and I asked him.
Jeffrey, can I jump in there just with a quick question? You know, because I've been looking at some of the situation and some of the facts surrounding your case for a little while. And I know that, you know, you've been doing a lot of research or you have folks helping you do research. And one of the things that I don't know if you'll be able to speak to this or not, but regarding, like, you know, we were talking earlier that there was no evidence, no marked money and so forth. And I saw some pieces of evidence that where you guys have done an analysis of serial numbers on dollars. Is that correct?
Yes.
So tell our listening audience about. I mean, I found that to be one of the. The whole thing as far as you being wrongly incarcerated is big enough. I mean, no one should be spending time in prison, having not committed any crimes. But the fact,
right,
the
right.
you having done the analysis of what supposedly was the money that was used and the tracking of these serial numbers. Talk a little bit about that for us.
Okay, well, after I had filed my direct appeal and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, they just denied and dismissed every legal proceeding I filed. They didn't even give any explanation. So I knew that the only way that I would be able to get back into court, I had to find some kind of new evidence. So I kept looking over and looking over and looking over the discovery after I got it, you know, after, you know, my trial. And I noticed that the serial numbers in the discovery was on the paper, but where the $100 bill, the photocopy of it supposed to be, it was left blank. So I got to thinking that there's something behind this $100 bill left blank. So I knew that the standard operating procedure was to sign this $100 bill out of state funds. And I said to myself, now, why would they write the serial numbers down of the $100 bill and then not photocopy the $100 bill when they're right there at the same place? So I started trying to find a numerical value of those serial numbers. And it took me 2 years to do it. I had to go to the Federal Bureau of Engraving and Printing under the Freedom of Information Act. And after going there a couple of times, they wouldn't respond to me. And then I finally wrote a letter to the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and they sent me a letter stating that the Federal Bureau of Engraving and Printing was the place for me to find out the numerical value of those numbers. So I sent that letter along with the Freedom of Information Act, and they finally gave me that information. And it revealed that the serial numbers actually came off of a $20 bill. And when I refiled to the Mississippi Supreme Court, they told me that I was time barred and success writ barred, and there is no exceptions to that. However, that's contrary to the statute, because under newly discovered evidence, there is no time bar. There is no time bar to constitutional violations as well, or a claim of actual innocence. And they just overlooked it. And I also filed to the Fifth Circuit stating the same thing. And they wrote me back and told me that I didn't show due diligence. Even I showed them all the places I went to during the 2 years to find that information.
Wow.
So what – go ahead, Bethel.
No, I wanted to say, I'm reading here that it says there's no evidence, there's no marked money, no drugs, no weapon, no audio tape, no videotape, no photos of any drugs, large sums of money, nothing. And there's no documentation from the Mississippi Crime Lab proving that any of the alleged evidence even existed. There is nothing to prove that a crime took place. So what is it that they – what evidence, what is it that they had? What is there anything that they said? I mean, could show?
They don't have anything. And see, when I was in the county jail, the officer that picked me up, he sent me a message by another inmate that came to the county jail, and he stated that there was no evidence on me, no evidence whatsoever. But Little June was going to testify that I sold him $100 worth of cocaine. Little June is the only state witness. Which his real name is Cleveland McCall. Now, I know the audience and a lot of you wondering why was this done to me. Trellis was an ex-police officer that had left the force, and he was a suspect of selling drugs. And, you know, they expect for us to turn against each other. And when they tried to intimidate me in every which way they could to get me to testify on Trellis, I wouldn't do it. So they forced me to go to trial, and went and got Little June out of the hospital after on a 5-day suicide watch just to punish me for not doing what they wanted me to do.
And so Jeffrey, right now, do you have a legal counsel? I mean, do you have an attorney that's fighting for you, or are you doing this stuff just pro se?
Just doing this pro se. I've been studying the law for the last 14 and a half years, and every time I file my paperwork, I file it exactly according to the law. But no court will ever adjudicate my claims on the merit, even though I tell them there's no evidence, shows them that there's no evidence, and shows them that the evidence they have against me is false. And I also introduced to them in black and white, my constitutional rights being violated. No court from the Mississippi Supreme Court, United States District Court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, or the United States Supreme Court will ever adjudicate my claims on the merit, especially my constitutional violations. They won't even mention it in the order. They just overlook it like it doesn't even exist.
And so, Maurice, with that, what is the remedy? What are you guys doing? Give us a little bit of information on how you guys are waging this battle. I know you said you went to Congressman Lewis, that didn't give you nothing, but what other headway are you guys making? Which direction are you guys heading in?
Yes, we firmly believe that in order to truly get justice in the court system is that we definitely have to put a lot of heat in the street. We have to make the attention of the world focus in on Mississippi. Just as they went and convicted a dude by the name of Killing for the murders in the 60s of the civil rights worker, and this same judge said that it doesn't do him any pleasure to do that because he was forced to do it because of the attention that was brought to bear down on Mississippi in that area. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to bring that same force, that same power to bear down on Mississippi. Now, the thing about it is they knew that we were coming because they called me. The DA called me on my cell phone, and he threatened me that once we get there, then he will definitely have a jail cell waiting for us so that we can be able to talk to Jeff right there across the hall. They are definitely afraid of our presence coming there and turning that place upside down. I've talked to many different residents there in that city, and they're fed up with the injustice, but they need somebody to help them to push this thing forward. So we got to go there and do exactly that. We got to go, and we got to push it forward. And as we expose the evil that's there, just as y'all were talking about earlier about the civil rights leaders then now are up in the high places looking down on us, we're going to expose that for what it is as well, because our people are sitting and crying for somebody to come and help them, and they make these phone calls and write letters to their offices that never get responded to. So we got to go over and turn it up. We got to show there is a new day today, and we're not going to take what you think you're going to give us. We got to make a new way and make it real.
Hey, Jeffrey, I know that you have special arrangements as far as getting this call. How much time do you have? We don't want to infringe upon that. We have a caller who wants to make a comment. So how much time do you have, Jeffrey?
Well, I got plenty of good time. If something happens, I just go silent.
Okay. All right, well, we got a caller that wants to join there. So go for it, Cliff.
Hey, we got Joanna from California. You have a question or comment for the guest?
Yeah, I do. I'm the friends of Jeffrey Wainsley and a bunch of us. I met Jeff on Twitter, and I read his story, and I was outraged. That man should not be in jail. I am disgusted, and I want people to visit his site. I want folks, if they can, to throw a few bucks so he can get an attorney and get the heck out of there, because he does not belong there. He's a good man. He didn't commit a crime. And he needs to be free. And that's all I've got to say. Free Jeffrey now.
Thank you very much, Joanna. That's what it takes.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to get – everybody has to get involved. And just like you say, Maurice, you know, you gotta expose the system. You got to expose the people who are in the system who claim that they're fighting for people's rights. And expose the fact that they're doing nothing to send you back and say, well, now you got to fight your own fight. It all has to be brought down. Like you said, we've got to make enough noise that the whole thing is exposed and that they're shown for who they are. It's like you've been put in place to fight, but instead of you fighting, we have people like Joanna in California and others who are trying to wage the war for Jeffrey. And, yeah, they lend their voice. They lend what they can. But it's not as loud as a congressman's
voice.
That's
right.
And that's why we gotta push them and press them until they do something.
And also, Maurice, did I hear you say that you were reaching out to Eric Holder's office, or you had, or what was your statement?
I had to go up to sit in his office until he finally came out the door, because I kept trying to get an appointment with him, or at least get him on the phone, and every time I tried, I was always brushed away. So I decided, well, since I'm up here, I'm going to sit in his office until he show up. And when he walked out that door, then I was on him, and that was how I was able to get 5 to 10 minutes of his time to talk to him about Jeff's case. Yes.
And what was his response?
Well, basically his thing was, well, you know, make sure you go ahead and present us with the, I think because we have filed a petition through the Justice Department, have them look at it. He said, well, make sure you do that and cross your I's and dot your T's, but make sure that you also understand, just because you sat and you talked to me, I'm not going to give you special preference where whatever you say is absolutely correct, because the court systems are set up with checks and balances, and if this case has went through all the checks and balances, then things can't be as you claim there to be. And he said, I'm not saying that you're lying or anything like that, because I see what you're presenting me, but I'm just saying that, you know, the court has its system. That's why you can't even present something for us to get involved unless you went through all of the steps. And basically, again, it was, you want him to be free, then you got to make it happen. You got to force us to do what needs to be done.
So, Maurice, how long ago was that?
That's what we have to do.
How long ago was that, Maurice?
That was last week.
That was last week?
Now, he stands in front of the nation.
That's why I asked the question.
In front of the nation and makes a statement, there's too many people incarcerated for no good
law enforcement reason.
He makes that in public.
Yeah.
Then he tells you behind he tells you behind closed door in his office, well, in essence, I'm not really going to do nothing just because you're in here talking to me about this. I mean, the system is basically, he's telling you the system is working, even though he gets up in front of the public and tell them the system is broken.
Yeah.
Wait, can I say something? That's the problem that we have. See, they say certain things in public, but they do something else behind closed doors.
That's right.
And the reason that I have, you know, tried to reach out to the media, because I feel that only one somebody, a powerful individual, can get on national TV and just ask the Mississippi Supreme Court, how can I be charged, tried, and convicted for the sale of a controlled substance? And the state never has to produce the evidence for which I'm charged, or even prove that it even exists.
And I
believe that one statement, that one question to the Mississippi Supreme Court would open up a firestorm as to what is going on down here in Mississippi.
But how do you get the Eric Holder? Because he's the person to make that
That's
statement.
The one.
He is the one who should say, if you don't have evidence against a man, let him out of prison. And to give you this explanation that, well, you know, the court did what it does, and if you presented everything to them and they still giving you the runaround, something must be wrong. Yeah, something is wrong with the court, not with your innocence. Something is wrong with them when they claim that the evidence of the money that was passed to you from an undercover somebody, when they claim that evidence is a $100 bill, and the Federal Reserve says, no, that's a $20 bill.
That's a problem.
You basically trumped up evidence.
I think that's evidence tampering.
Yes,
that is
evidence tampering. That's
making up evidence.
The reason that this happened is because the crime never happened. Mm-hmm. And because they couldn't intimidate me, they had to rush my trial. Now, they assumed that I didn't have the knowledge, or I was just going to come to prison and just sit down and not try to find that evidence. So they just did whatever they wanted to do, thinking that everybody was going to come in and just sit down and just accept what they did. But I didn't do that. And see, when they rushed my trial, they rushed themselves.
So Jeffrey,
adds up.
What about some of the other advocacy groups like the Mississippi Innocence Project or something like that? And I think you probably have submitted your case to just about everybody you can think of, I would assume.
Yes, over the last 14 years, I've submitted it to everybody. And most of the Innocence Project, well, not most of them, all of them, tell me they only deal with cases with DNA. And my case doesn't involve DNA, so I was lost out. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the NAACP, local, national, and the Ethics Commission, all of these groups, no one would ever respond. I reached out to every attorney that I could think of. Nobody would ever respond.
What did the NAACP say?
They didn't respond.
Wow. That's not a
while. When I went on PASS in 2012, I talked to Mr. Charles Hampton, presented my case to him and everything, sent it to him and everything. And he talked to me for about an hour, and I was hoping that he was going to do something. But after that conversation, he never would return any of my phone calls, any of my letters or anything. And basically, that's what I've been getting for the last 14 years. Nobody would ever do anything. Some lawyers would write me back and tell me not to give up, and they didn't have time, and, you know, just making excuses. So that's why I had to turn to the media. That's why I'm talking to you all now, because I think this is my best way of trying to get my case exposed.
Yeah.
Right.
I understand you're a veteran, military veteran, Jeffrey.
Yes. Yes, I served from 1976 to 1980. And that kind of shocked me, too, that I was willing to die for this country, but yet and still I can't even get my constitutional rights upheld.
Absolutely.
Now, Jeffrey, this is a state-level case. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, you were prosecuted under state, not federal.
Yes, it's a state level.
Yeah.
Everything that concerns my case, the most important issues, it's on my website. Anybody can go to my website and read the entire case.
Mm-hmm.
I got my case on there, and I got all the analysis where, you know, I'm showing where the evidence doesn't exist. And I also have some orders on there where I've received back from the court making rulings contrary to their own law.
I think that's where I a little while back, that's where I saw that thing with the money, and that just blew me away. I'm looking at, and it was like, how can you have dollar bills that you're saying were part of a transaction, and the serial numbers don't even match what you're saying that the denomination is supposed to be?
And then how can the court ignore that and on some technicality tell you that you can't present it? That is,
right,
and you
right.
You said, was that the Mississippi Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court?
It was the Mississippi Supreme Court, and after they denied it, saying that, you know, my motion was not well taken, which I have never seen a law saying not well taken, I filed it to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And they wrote me back and told me I didn't show due diligence. And I was assuming that the evidence itself shows due diligence. To even obtain the evidence is due diligence.
Exactly.
But they said I didn't show it, and they denied it also.
So, Jeffrey, what do you say that one of the things you're doing is obviously reaching out to the media and reaching out to groups like ours to help to spread the word about your case. What other activities do you have going on then, Maurice? I'm going to ask you the same question after Jeffrey answers. But what other things do you have going on right now, Jeffrey, in the legal realm as well as just, you know, through, you know, social media, what have you?
Well, the only thing I have going now is trying to get my case exposed into the media because I've exhausted all my remedies in the court. I filed a habeas corpus in 2012. To the United States District Court, Southern District of Mississippi, and I raised the same issue along with the enhancement, which they are also holding me unlawfully past my parole date, and he wouldn't even entertain the idea of me being wrongfully convicted. However, he did issue a memorandum order and opinion as far as my parole eligibility, But the state didn't like that order, so they filed an appeal to the Fifth Circuit, which has been 6 months already, and they usually make a ruling within 6 months. So I'm just sitting waiting, and the only thing I'm trying to do is just get my case exposed in the media, trying to find somebody that's willing to, you know, get on national TV and just ask the Mississippi Supreme Court a simple question. How can they hold me for over 14 and a half years and never has to prove, I mean, never have to produce the evidence they got me charged with? I mean, that's ridiculous in America. And you trying to establish democracy all over the world, but yet instead you got people right here in this country won't even abide by the Constitution that you have and don't look like you can force them to abide by the Constitution.
That's
correct.
Now, Jeffrey, am I correct that Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz was one of the justices that that basically struck down your motion?
Yes, he was. And I don't know if he actually read my case or not, but he had his name on one of my orders denying me relief after I have showed them the evidence that doesn't exist. At one time, I filed to the Mississippi Supreme Court, and they issued an order back to me threatening me, told me that if I didn't stop filing paperwork, that they was going to pull sanctions on me, even monetary sanctions.
What?
I hate that I didn't preserve that order, because they told me that if I didn't stop filing paperwork, that they were going to pull sanctions on me, even monetary sanctions. In other words, they were going to fine me for wanting to get my freedom.
Right.
So just sit down and shut up, huh?
Now,
yeah.
Just
go on and accept what they did.
Maurice, have you guys reached out to Oliver Diaz about Jeffrey's case?
No, we haven't. I just talked to Olivia this morning about it, and we will be reaching out to him to see what all he could do, since he's now learning that everything that's supposed to be right is not right.
We're
going to be reaching out to him.
Yeah, definitely reach out to him and let us know.
That's right.
What that response is. We had him on the show 2 days ago, and his story is another tragic one.
Yeah.
But like you say, he now realizes that the Mississippi State is not who he thought it was when he was on their court of appeal.
That's
so
right.
Definitely, once you get in touch with him and talk to him about the situation, let us know. What his response is, because Jeffrey, you've done everything that you should do, and
that's
instead
right.
of them even addressing your situation, none of them have addressed the fact of your
evidence.
They're throwing stuff out saying we're gonna sanction you if you keep trying to get free. You didn't do some due diligence. Deal with my evidence.
That's
is the
right.
evidence that I presented is this real? Just find me that $100 bill. Check into that $100 bill and tell me what's going on there. That one thing right there is like, okay, this is fake, contrived evidence. This crime, like you say, never even took place.
Yep. So Maurice,
they won't give me a new trial or anything like that, because in the response from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, they state that they does not have photocopies of money they put in circulation. So there's no way in the world they could get a copy of this $100 bill. So if they gave me a new trial, what evidence are they going to bring back?
Exactly.
There's no evidence to bring back.
And the fact that, I mean, they get caught for prosecutorial misconduct, but the fact that the serial number
exactly.
they provided as evidence is a $20 bill.
That's right.
There ain't no way you ain't finding that $100 bill because it don't exist.
Right. And see, prosecutor committed a crime because he knew that he didn't have the evidence before he even brought me to trial. And another question I always thought about is what evidence did they present to the grand jury for them to even turn an indictment?
That's true.
They said committed a crime. That's all it takes for a grand jury. They go up there and put a piece of cheese on the seat and say, we want to get an indictment on this piece of cheese. We're going to name him Jeffrey Wansley. And we have that. And that's how easy it comes back.
That's the truth.
It's
about the truth.
So, Maurice, what do you have lined up as far as upcoming events or things that you want our listeners to get involved in, whether it be through, you know, tweeting or email or petition or something like that in support of Jeffrey? What do you have going on, Maurice?
Yes, we're going to be going down to Mississippi sometime in June, probably end of June. To go down there and start ruffling the feathers. We would definitely appreciate for everybody if y'all can go out to Jeffrey's website, look over the information, sign up as a supporter. We got a Facebook page, the Abduction and Crucifixion of Jeffrey Wansley. Join the Facebook page. We're going to meet everybody that we can because they've already made it clear when they called me that when we go to Mississippi, we're going to jail. So we're going to need you all support because we're going to need you all to help get us out by making sure that they know that everybody is watching. And this is not going to be something that they can sweep under the rug and think it's going to go. Because as Jeff said, they know if this gets out and Jeff gets free, they're going to jail. It's not going to be something you can just let it go. They're going to jail themselves. So, you know, that's why they put that call out to me to try to pump me to make me afraid to go down there and do what needs to be done. So we got to get him out. We got to get him out.
That's right. And go down there and let them know you streaming live video straight to your Facebook page, straight to the website, everywhere. You got video cameras on everything that you're doing, and y'all doing a documentary and streaming the Jeffrey Wansley case live as it happened, as you talking to the authorities.
Yep.
So, Jeffrey, it sounds like you have a good network of folks who, I mean, we got that call from California, and I was looking at on your website, you have a petition out there that folks from all over the place have signed the petition. Whatever happened to the attorney that was part of your case as far as the appellate case and Mr. Phillips, at least, you know, that's the name that's showing up on some of your appellate documents.
Yes, he's probably still in private practice right now. I haven't heard anything from him, but he was from Newton, and he basically just forced his appeal on me because I had my sister to go tell him that I didn't require his services. I was still trying to get my own attorney to do my own appeal, and he just told my sister he was going to file an appeal in my behalf anyway. So I sent him 25 pages. Basically, I sent him my direct appeal, and along with my direct appeal pro se and all the information I sent him, which he could put it in legal terms, I thought maybe that would help. And he didn't use one page that I had sent him in my behalf. He just put down there one issue, and that was that I was found guilty against the overwhelming weight of evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where he is right now, I don't know. But Mr. Robert Brooks, my court-appointed attorney, whom he forced himself on me, you know, he could have got everything squashed right there at trial because he knew that it wasn't any evidence. And he admitted to me that he knew that it wasn't any evidence. But, you know, he failed to tell the jury that how can y'all convict this man and nobody have shown y'all any evidence. He could have stopped the trial right there dead in his track. And I spoke with a deputy sheriff when I went to my rehearing, and he told me that it was a hung jury. And I don't know how to tell you it was off the record. But I believe it was a hung jury. And, you know, due to the way Marcus Garden did the end of the trial, like I stated in my direct appeal, you could see that was fishy. That didn't have nothing to do with courtroom etiquette. He just did what he wanted to do.
Yeah. All right, so this is Jeffrey Wansley and the story of a man who's been incarcerated for over 14 years fighting against a wrongful conviction. We asked our listeners if you would go out to www.jeffreywansley.com. That's J-E-F-F-E-R-Y. WANSLEY.com. And he is still, you know, in the fight, trying to get his case overturned. I mean, the man has been incarcerated for 14 years.
14 years.
On a 30-year sentence.
Gosh. And no evidence.
And then we got Maurice Muhammad, who's also helping out there. And I know, Maurice, we're going to get some information from you off offline as far as being able to post some information as far as different activities that you have going on. And our listeners, you can go out there and get a lot more information on Jeffrey and support his cause. Again, gentlemen, thank you for joining us on A Just Cause Coast to Coast. And we will have information posted on AJCRadio.com. AJCRadio.com regarding the Jeffrey Wansley case. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks, Maurice.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
NAACP has a new definition. They're all cowards with no conviction. I just want to let you know what the NAACP stands for. NAACP. I need you to answer.
Come on, y'all.
Tell me what you think about
this. It's Al, a reverend. Does it right? And does it care about you?
No, no.
What about
Will
he?
No, no.
What about Jesse?
Or what about the rainbow?
Does it keep hope alive? What about Oprah?
No, no.
Will she?
No, no.
And does she care about folks at
home? No, no.
Will they help that people?
No, no.
Will they fight for you?
No, no.
Do they care about justice?
No, no.
So tell me, is it Obama?
Opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. I wish we had more time to talk to Maurice and Jeffrey. I mean, and even just talking about all the places that Maurice went to, and all the folks, and he's experienced a lot of the same things that we've experienced. And we were just talking about it during the break. you know, the thing with Attorney General Eric Holder. And that just last week, are you kidding me? Last week he tells the man that, well, you know, I'm not just going to, you know, take what you're saying. It's like, it's almost like I'm going to hear you, but I'm not going to consider what
it's
you
like,
have to
it's
say.
Like, it's like he's telling, I'm going to give you lip service.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to, I'm going to be your sounding board here for this 30 minutes. Then I'm not doing nothing.
I doubt if he even, I mean, 30,
He said 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be your sounding board for this 10 minutes. I'm not doing anything.
Exactly.
So don't expect anything of me.
Even though you have the evidence right here in front of me.
And then the thing with Judge Diaz.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's heavy.
I'm very
More to come on that one because, you know, Judge Diaz and his whole family were subjected to all kinds of injustice. And now here's a situation where, you know, granted, he's not a judge anymore, but he probably knows some people. And he can make some calls or something.
He is an attorney.
He is an attorney. Yep. That's a good point, Cliff. He is an attorney.
If you ignore this man, you can at least go to battle for him.
That's right. And so, you know, more to come on that. And I know Olivia is going to give Maurice and Jeffrey a lot of information on that. So as far as the Just Cause Coast to Coast and our support of the IRP6, we are still pushing on our effort as far as the over 200 pages of transcript that need to be, you know, brought to the attention of the folks in Washington, D.C. or whomever in the court systems, in the federal court system, because, you know, an investigation needs to be done on all this kind of stuff. When you hear Jeffrey's story and people start monkeying around with serial numbers on money and all this kind of stuff, when people start just making transcripts disappear, IRP6, go out to change.org, do a search on IRP6, change.org, do a search on IRP6. Sign that petition. The IRP6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper. Also, for more information about the IRP6, go to freetheirp6.org. Freetheirp6.org. There's a lot of interesting information out there that you can read up on. Go to a-justcause.com, a-justcause.com to find out more information about A Just Cause, and ajcradio.com to get archives of our programs, see some of the interesting folks that we've had on there. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. As always, pray for our brothers, the IRP6. Ethel, what else are we asking our listeners to do?
Absolutely. We are asking people to pick up the phone and call Eric Holder's office. He's the Attorney General of the United States. He's the High Sheriff. And ask him, why has he not done an inquiry or an investigation into the over 200 pages of missing trial transcript in the case of the IRP6. He needs to do something. We don't want lip service. We need action.
Right. We also want to reach out to the jurors of the IRP6 case. We know that the decision you came to was because of the lies and misinformation that you got from Judge Christine Arguello. If you have questions about what we have found out about that missing transcript or anything else that transpired during the trial, if you want to see the evidence or the letter that Andrew Alvarelli, the expert witness that you watched get pulled off the stand, you want to see the letter he wrote, get in contact with us. We'll give you everything that we have. 855-529-4252 or reach us at contact@a-justcause.com.
Also, Cliff, you mentioned a little bit ago about Tracy Collins, the investigative reporter in the U.K., and she's doing exhaustive investigation of the IRP6 case. So we're looking forward to seeing what she's going to come up with. Also, go out to Huffington Post, do a search on Judge H. Lee Sarakin. Huffington Post, do a search on Judge H. Lee Sarakin. And he has a three-part series on the missing transcript involved in the IRP6 case. Also want to just throw out there our support for Senator Leahy and the Justice for All Act. The Justice for All Act. We're asking our listeners to write to your congressmen and representatives in support of the Justice for All Act. That is sorely needed, and we need them to push that through Congress.
Absolutely. And you guys, I did not give you Eric Holder's phone number again. I apologize for that, but the number is 202-514-2003 and 2005.
All right, I want to say thank you for Maurice Muhammad and Jeffrey Wansley spending evening with us. Also, for everybody in the chat room, thank you for your comments and questions. Thank you for all of our callers that called in. To our crew, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson helping out Ill Skillers Girl in the control room. And to the production support team, they give us the information that we need to deliver to you, to the truth. We know you're out there, and we appreciate you.
Join us each Tuesday and Thursday right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 6 to 8 Mountain Time, for A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. And in the words of Bishop Desmond Tutu, if you're neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
Good night, America.
Good night, y'all.
Good night.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.